This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Kevin Kwan. He's author of the book China Rich Girlfriend, which just came out in paperback. It's the second book in a trilogy. The first was Crazy Rich Asians. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be here.
Great to have you here. These books are fascinating to me as an American reader who has really no connection to contemporary Asian culture. You are describing in these books a world of extremely wealthy people in Singapore and Hong Kong, Shanghai, U.S. They have far more money than anyone could ever need. They spend it in crazy ways. What is your own connection to this world? Is this where you're from?
I was born in Singapore, and I grew up there for the first 11 years of my life. And I did come from a family that was very interconnected with these sort of families of privilege in Asia. So, you know, they always say, write what you know in creative writing school. And one day I finally got around to it.
The Byzantine rules of society are part of what is so fascinating about these books. I mean, one of the plots that illustrates this is about a young woman, former soap opera star named Kitty Pong. She wants to enter the highest levels of society in Hong Kong, but she's looked down on, and then she hires a consultant, and there's a great deal of comedy that ensues in the way these two people work together. What's going on? What is the nature of this very, I mean, people throw around the word exclusive, but this is a literally exclusive world. Most people are excluded from it.
You know, I think there are these very insular circles of privilege that exist in Asia. And I think they've had to for thousands of years because people live so ganged up against each other. You know, in China with the massive populations, in countries like Singapore and Hong Kong, where everyone is in such close proximity to each other. I think there's been this social hierarchy that's sort of begun, you know, for hundreds of years. And this has carried over even to modern day. So it's very, very hard to break into these higher echelons. You know, just having money is an entree. It's about breeding, it's about family pedigree, and, you know, when I talk about pedigree, I'm talking about family trees that go back literally 1,000 years.
Right.
So it's to me, it's fascinating. And I never really was too aware of this until I started going back into my own family history and, you know, sort of digging up into the family tree and this and that, and seeing all the just arcane references and how, you know, my family goes back to, I think, 93 AD. I think that's from the family tree book. So it's sort of fascinating to see all, you know, the whole span of time and how important
right. This
is to some people.
And what those things mean. In other words, like, let's say you've got a family tree that goes back, but somebody in that tree in the year 1327 did something terrible. Does that blacken your name? I mean, what is the significance of the actual people in that family tree?
Absolutely. You know, things that your ancestors have done really directly affect your life 400 years later.
Is that
true? Because I think so. Absolutely. Because it really, you know, it depends how much also the family has recovered from the scandal from 400 years ago. But, you know, snobbery is snobbery. And these are all ways to stratify and to exclude, which I find fascinating. And it just sort of really reminds me so much of what happens in, you know, in the books of Trollope or Jane Austen. You know, there's this commonality between these dynastic alliances and the obsession with, you know, the purity of the blood and bloodlines, things like that. And it's very much alive and well in Asia
right. To
this current day.
Things that are total fictions. Scientifically, there is no such thing as a pure bloodline.
Exactly. You know, and in fact, I think one character in my book, you know, in the book one, you know, comments that, you know, if you go back all the way, everyone's related to an emperor.
Right.
Or we're all peasants if you go back far enough. So what does it really matter? But I think this also provides really the comedy of the book that
exactly. Some
people care so much.
Well, we'll go back to the book in a second, but I think your story as background for this book is so interesting because you came to the United States at age 11, not having fully really understood what kind of world you came from, if I understand correctly, and then were put in this sort of American class structure, which works in different ways. How did you come to understand your own family background and its meaning?
I think it really came from the experience of leaving Singapore and being plopped down into the middle of suburban America. You know, I was in Houston, Texas, which is as suburban and sort of middle America as you can get in many ways, and seeing the contrast between how families behaved and how people lived compared to how I'd grown up. And then it was really clarified for me as, you know, I began reading, and, you know, I went to school at first in the University of Houston, and I was a literature minor, and I would read a lot of these books, you know, Louis Auchincloss, people like that, and even F. Scott Fitzgerald, you know, authors like that, and you would start to really see the nuances of the East Coast sort of hierarchy, the American aristocracy.
Exactly.
And when I finally did move to New York for my further studies in college and began to get to know some of these people and these families, I really realized, oh, wow, there's such a commonality between WASPy Upper East Side Park Avenue families and a lot of these old families in Singapore and in Hong Kong. The modes of behavior are exactly alike. You know, this obsession with appearances, but appearing as sort of unkept and as sort of disheveled and sort of old money patinaed as possible versus the gloss of new money and then appearing too sort of blingy, things like that.
And we see all of those things in your books, the old money, the new money,
and the brand new money.
And the brand
new
money.
Coming out of mainland China, which I call the China rich.
Exactly. And it really struck me that in this class of people, or this sort of multi-class structure, but I mean, they're all super wealthy people, you wonder if anybody's really happy because they're all watching each other and they're conscious of being watched all the time.
It's a gilded goldfish bowl.
Yeah.
And even more so on a tiny island like Singapore.
Right.
You know, where everyone knows the village gossip, really. You know, Nicholas Young, my protagonist, can't, you know, he can sneeze in New York and someone will notice in Singapore, in a way, through this sort of labyrinthine network of gossip that
right.
spreads around the world. And that's literally happened to me in my life, you know.
Facilitated by Instagram, Facebook, and all that stuff.
No, this was even pre-Instagram. I mean, I remember, you know, many, many years ago, my mother had called me. I was living in New York at the time. My mom called me up and asked me if I wanted to meet her in London in a couple of weeks. She was gonna be there. She was gonna meeting up with some of the relatives, and she's like, "Oh, you should come if you have time." And I thought about it, and I was like, "Oh, well, let me think about it." I put down the phone. About an hour later, an aunt in Singapore calls me and says, "Oh, I hear you're going to London." And I said, "How did you hear this? I haven't even decided yet." But somehow, through the grapevine, she had literally heard it from a nurse in a doctor's office.
Right.
That I was coming. I was gonna be in London meeting my mother. And I was like, this is so absurd. And it can only happen in this strange little global village of you know, sort of overseas Chinese.
Who are the 0.1%, as we call the 1% in this country, of their worlds, which is really not all that many people. And so in your book, this kind of thing that happened to you about London gets taken to an extreme where somebody is sitting in a cafe and somebody who had known them years ago and met them exactly once takes a picture and it goes viral and everybody's talking about it because this guy is sitting in a cafe with his girlfriend and he's one of those people.
Absolutely.
And so that's the thing. And I think, I mean, it seems, first of all, an exhausting way to live because there's not the freedom to relax, to explore, to make mistakes, to see maybe who you might be inside that isn't exactly the same as the society from which you come. And it does, for me, sort of call into question the very word privilege. I mean, there is a privilege that this world of people has in terms of mobility, in terms of being able to buy what they want. The food in the book is unbelievably, I mean, I was salivating reading about all the
things
they
ate. There's a lot of food porn.
There's a lot of food porn in the book, exactly. But at the same time, somebody who might come from a much humbler existence has
so
a
much
lot,
more freedom.
A
so
lot
much
more
freedom.
Yeah.
To choose what they want to do with their lives, to choose who they want to marry. You know, their lives are much less controlled than they are. If you were, say, in a family, you know, like this, if you were a Crazy Rich Asian, I think there's so much more that you're beholden to, so much more duty and so much more familial obligation.
One of the things that fascinates me about this is that there doesn't seem to be much of a noblesse oblige. In other words, there might be a sense of duty to the people in one's own family and circle, but the crazy wealth that is being generated doesn't seem to be any sense of duty to the people maybe at the lower echelons of the company that is responsible for putting this wealth in the hands of the people on the top. I mean, when you look at what duty means, what does it mean for maybe one of the company owners of the type that you write about?
I think there actually is very much a sense of noblesse oblige with these families, and it's something that's indoctrinated into your life at a very early age, especially, I think, in many of these old many families that have owned companies or empires for generations. You really do feel that you are kind of the paterfamilias of your entire clan. You know, first of all, your duty is to your family, then to your greater clan, and then to your company. So it does trickle down. I do feel, I have seen that, where if you're an employee of a company, you know, that's owned by this tycoon or something, they really do treat you like family in a way that's really not seen much in the West.
And so the people at the bottom, because I mean, we hear these stories about people living in dormitories doing this kind of like high technology piece work. And their dormitories have suicide nets because they will jump out of the window and die because their lives are so miserable.
That is a very new phenomenon. And that distinguishes the overseas Chinese I write about in Crazy Rich Asians from the China Rich, which is a completely different breed, a whole new, you know, type of wealth that's very new, that comes specifically from mainland China. You know, you have these people who literally there isn't a single fortune from mainland China that's over 20 years old. You know, the country was very much a communist regime.
Right.
It still is on paper, you know, until Deng Xiaoping decided that he wanted everyone to, you know, to get richest is to be glorious and allowed, you know, the markets to open up and allowed free enterprise to flow. So that's a whole other ballgame of people that have made massive amounts of money, billions of dollars in the past decade, you know, through all these deals, through having these manufacturing companies and factories. You know, they're making the screens for Apple, iPhones, things like that, and they do not have the same value system at all as the overseas Chinese from the book Crazy Rich Asians. It's very strange, and it's something I sort of discovered as I began doing research into book two, China Rich Girlfriend, just how culturally different the mainland Chinese have become, because, you know, Mao so successfully obliterated the culture.
Yeah.
And the values and the value systems for, you know, 50 years. So the new generation are completely unrelated in any way to the traditional overseas Chinese communities in Singapore and Hong Kong, in the U.S., in Taiwan. Totally different.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, what I'm hearing you say is that the attempt to eradicate the class system, in fact, eradicated what might have been left of the noblesse oblige, and then ended up creating a class system far more grotesque than perhaps what had even been there before?
That's one way of looking at it. And I think many people would agree. And I think that's why there's so many systems of snobberies in place. You know, in countries like Singapore, Hong Kong, Taiwan, they very much look down on the mainland Chinese. You know, the tensions are very, very visible and very palpable. I mean, there's a very famous website called Shanghaiist that's based in Hong Kong, I believe, that every day all they do is report the crazy antics of the mainland Chinese when they visit countries like Hong Kong and Singapore.
Yeah.
You know, just sort of the outrageous behavior of this sort of very, very nouveau riche crowd. And you know, there very much are tensions. And, you know, if you ask probably a Hong Konger what they think of the mainland Chinese, they would say something far more undiplomatic than I would ever be able to say.
Very, very interesting. Yeah. We're talking to Kevin Kwan about his book, China Rich Girlfriend, and the book, Crazy Rich Asians. One thing that was interesting to me when I was reading China Rich Girlfriend was the character Rachel. She is what you call an ABC, American-born Chinese. And she is engaged to Nicholas Young, who is from one of these families. And in the first book, we see his family tree going way back. She is a professor of economics, raised in the U.S., and yet she seems to be uncritical of this crazy opulence. How do you understand her character in that respect?
I actually think she's quite critical of it.
Do you?
Yeah, I do.
I mean, I just kept seeing she's going to a spa and enjoying every second of it, and she's eating this food and being so grateful for it.
That's so interesting. I think, you know, in Crazy Rich Asians, in the first book, when she first encounters Asia for the first time, and is taken to Singapore by Nick and introduced to this world of sort of extreme wealth and luxury, she's just in shock, first of all, that this even exists, that this level of privilege, that this sort of imperial splendor in how people live exists. And I think she really, to me, she has a hard time dealing with it. She's not prepared for the bitchery of all the other women that come out, you know, with their knives sharpened, because they're afraid she's going to take one of their eligible men.
Right.
And so I think there is an attraction to this world because it's so new and so novel to her. And yet she does say several times, you know, throughout the book, you know, she does talk about how this is so in contrast to the rest of the world. And, you know, and you know, her specialties in sort of micro lending to poor African communities. So she mentions that, and she sort of, you know, and I don't want to give away too much, but, you know, I think there are monologues and diatribes she makes towards the end of the book that really show how conflicted she is and how much she doesn't feel like she's part of this world, number one, and she doesn't want to be part of this world because she finds it abhorrent.
Maybe by the second book she's gotten used to it. Because that's what I have fresh in my mind.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, okay. Go back and read it.
Yeah, I'll go back and read that. Go back and finish the first. I haven't finished the first book.
Exactly. She's not meant to be overly sympathetic of this world. In fact, she's the critical conscience of this world. But maybe I'm not doing a good enough job.
No. I think there. It might be a first book, second book thing.
Yeah.
Because by the time we get to the second book, she is, well, again, we don't want to give away too much of the plot, because, ladies and gentlemen, you should read these books because they're such an interesting combination of great storytelling, dishy kind of, like, I don't want to lower it by saying soap opera, but like the kind of intrigue that you might have in a Downton Abbey or something like that. And then this fascinating cultural world that your American readers, you know, non-Asian readers might not have that much connection to.
As one critic said, this is the Real Housewives of the Joy Luck Club.
Yeah, there you go. That's what I was looking for.
But thank you. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah, no, it's really fun to read. And I have to say also, it was really interesting for me. I listened to the second book, China Rich Girlfriend, on audiobook. And the experience of that was, it added a dimension to it, because the reader is an actress named Lydia Look, and her ability to differentiate the voices and kind of give us a sense of who they are and how they sound and what their bitchiness or calmness or coolness or whatever, what emotion, and those emotions associated with their place in the class structure. She did an amazing job.
She really did. Lydia is just an amazing, brilliant actress. She's a, you know, she's a critically acclaimed actress in Singapore, does a lot of amazing theater and television and films. And she really, you know, I worked with her on the audiobook, sort of coaching her with the various accents, but she knew how to do all of them. And so more important than the, you know, the difference between a Singaporean British accent and a Hong Kong British accent, it's the levels of snobbery in the accents. And, you know, they're so subtle, and yet she was able to master all of them. And I think it really gives that audiobook such a richness in terms of, you really get a feel for where these characters come from. You know, this one was Oxford educated. This one obviously went to school in Australia and had a much lesser degree. But it's all these various arcane levels of snobbery and sort of social structures.
To what extent do you think those arcane levels of snobbery and social structures are related directly to British colonialism? Because the kind of difference in accents that you're talking about maps in a lot of ways onto the difference in accents in England that people are, for example, sometimes looking for when they send their sons to a boarding school so he'll have the right accent.
There is a direct correlation because Singapore and Hong Kong, they both used to be British Crown colonies. And so what emerged in Singapore was a whole sort of subculture, you know, of people called the Straits Chinese. These were the Chinese that intermarried with the local Malays. But more than that, they were all educated in England for the most part. They all grew up speaking English. They carried British passports. And they very much, you know, sort of differentiated themselves from the local Chinese populations in Singapore. They were the elite. And so for them, it was a badge of courage to come from a family that hasn't spoken Chinese in three generations, wouldn't even know how to.
So these people actually don't, some of these people don't speak Chinese at all?
They don't. I mean, I don't speak Chinese at all.
Yeah.
My parents don't speak Chinese. My grandparents speak some Chinese, but, you know, I guess to some people it could be a matter of pride that, oh, I'm a Chinese, ethnic Chinese person. That comes from a family that hasn't spoken the language in three generations. You know, personally, I wish I could speak Chinese. You know, it'd make travel to China much easier for me, and I'm sort of fascinated by the language. But, you know, it's a very, very hard language to learn.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. And so these modes of behavior ape the British and the aristocratic classes of the British.
I was sure that you were a Chinese speaker because the book is full of footnotes that reference very specific Chinese expressions that people use to mean certain things and ways of often putting another person down.
Exactly.
But other things as well.
Well, that's interesting. That's most of that is called Singlish, which is a patois combining English, Malay, Indian, and Chinese phrases that developed exclusively in Singapore and Malaysia. And so only through that do I know sort of the best, you know, sort of Mandarin or Hokkien or Cantonese swear words that I could put into the novel. But beyond that, you know, I wouldn't even be able to order at a restaurant in Shanghai.
So one of the pieces of this also is that so many of the Asian characters have very European names to an almost comical degree, like Astrid and Araminta and Carlton and Corinna. So that's just part of this whole thing.
It very much is. And I mean, and the names are actually, in reality, there are so many more outlandish names that I've come across.
Like what?
You know, I mean, there's a family in my book that I sort of very, very much sort of satirize. And, you know, the children are like Constantine, Augustine,
right.
Callista, you know, they're all named after sort of Greek and Byzantine mythology. And it gets, from there, it gets even worse. And that's also a social demarcation of how nouveau riche you are, you know, in terms of how you name your children, you know, how waspy sounding are the names. Are they more like Victoria and Felicity, or are they more like Constantine and Augustine? You know, there are these subtle differences that sort of tell you what kind of family this is we're talking about.
We're talking to author Kevin Kwan about his books, Crazy Rich Asians and China Rich Girlfriend. One of the characters in the book who is completely over the top is named Colette. Tell us a little bit about her, how you conceived of her. I wondered if she was based on anybody.
You know, Colette really is inspired by quite a few people. And, you know, there is a new culture of what they call the second generation rich in mainland China now. These are the children of you know, of people who made money in the 80s, basically. And so they've never known the poverty that their parents did. You know, their parents all came from, you know, the sort of the working class communist regime, but they've always grown up in privilege. So they are the first generation of nouveau riche in China. And they live like prince and princesses, and they have a degree of privilege and access that ordinary Chinese do not have. And it's become really a matter of contention in China. I mean, the Chinese government is really actively trying to clamp down on the excesses of these second-generation rich kids, because, you know, they're able to live lives. You know, like when you have a trust fund of $100 million or more when you're 18 years old, you can do a lot of damage. And so the exploits of the, these China rich have been very much reported in the international press, you know. And so she's really kind of the prototypical China rich girl, in my opinion, you know, born to extreme privilege without the value system of, say, a family that's been able to handle money over generations and learn how to, you know, respect money and sort of, and you know, sort of teach their children a certain value system. And so she, for her, you know, the world is her oyster. She has three aeroplanes and she's doing shopping sprees all over the world. And she builds a private resort for herself, you know, outside of Shanghai. And these, you know, all these stories are very, very much based on real things that I've personally witnessed. There's nothing in my books that's made up, quite frankly.
Well, I read somewhere that you actually toned down some of the excesses because your publisher told you that people wouldn't believe it.
Yeah, it would be unbelievable. Exactly.
Can you think of any examples of that offhand?
You know, I think there was one scene in which, you know, a character jumps on yet another helicopter and lands, you know, in a certain place. And my editor said, you know, there's too many helicopters, too many private jets. Like, you need to just tone it down because it's getting a bit unbelievable here. And I said, well, you know what? This is how these people travel. You know, like, they have their personal helicopters. They have their personal jets.
They have
even to fly, you know, half an hour away. You know, they go everywhere by jet.
They have their personal jets with a surgeon on call and an operating theater in the airplane should there be a medical problem.
Exactly. Or private yoga rooms.
Yeah.
In their personal jets. So it's, you know, it's really jaw-dropping what this sudden wealth in China has done and created this whole new breed of people that sort of, you know, and you see them here now, you know, they're buying up real estate around the world.
Yeah.
In New York, in Los Angeles.
Vancouver.
Vancouver has, you know, been really ruined in a way by the China rich. And so it's a problem that's now affecting the rest of the world. And Colette sort of is sort of the flashpoint for all this.
And I find it fascinating that their parents, who, as you said, grew up under communism, grew up with a kind of poverty that these children have never known, don't somehow keep certain things in line or have some sense of humility. I mean, what is their part in it?
You know, I think it's a combination of guilt, number one, because so many of these parents, you know, have really neglected their children. They've spent the formative years of these kids' lives, they've been busy working and building their empires. So money becomes the opiate. Money becomes the way of just, you know, showing love. But the other issue here is that so much of this sort of free spending and this sort of access is in such a direct response to the oppression that these people have felt for the past century.
Yeah.
You know, they were living under such, you know, sort of dire circumstances for so long that the minute you open the money spigot and they went from being literally peasants living in a village to having $100 million overnight, how does one live? How does one react? You want to celebrate being out of jail. You want to celebrate being out of, you know, this lifestyle of duress. And in a way, I've even heard it say, some of the spending they do is they're making up for lost generations. They're doing this in honor of their parents and grandparents that had to suffer and through famines and things like that. It's sort of this karmic payback.
Right.
Which is so fascinating.
It really is.
So you have to have a certain degree of empathy for these people. They don't really have an awareness of what they're doing. This is all new for them. It's very much like the Beverly Hillbillies in a way. You know, you strike oil in your backyard and you move to Beverly Hills and what do? You know, you want to sort of enjoy your life. You know, and hopefully the next generation begins to develop a set of mores that helps to guide the family in a less dysfunctional way.
It's not only having empathy for them, it's also just observing in a kind of objective way the dynamics of extremist social movements. It's kind of an argument for moderation. It's kind of an argument for incrementalism in a way.
It really is, and it's quite an argument for estate taxes too.
Yeah.
Because, you know, one of the interesting things about wealth in Asia is that, you know, there are no estate taxes, and so there's a very little need to you know, for families to set up sort of these trust funds that, you know, in the U.S. are used really as tax planning, you know, and intergenerational wealth transfer schemes. Whereas here, you know, in Asia, a father can just basically deposit $50 million into their daughter or son's bank account with no issue.
Right.
At the same time, they can also withhold all that money. You know, that creates another level of conflict that you see in my books, where the patriarchs or matriarchs of the family hang on to every last cent until their dying breath. And so their children, their adult children, are infantilized and sort of live under the control of their parents well into their late adulthood.
There are some funny moments where you see people who will spend on a handbag an American family's annual food budget, but then they'll go to the hotel and say, can you imagine what they're charging for a plate of eggs in this hotel?
Yeah, for fried rice or for bottled water. You know, there's a famous scene in book two where a very, very wealthy individual is hoarding bottled water in the hotel room and stealing all the shampoos. And that's the comedy of the book. And you see so much of that because, you know, you're conscious of the thrift that existed or the memory of thrift that existed in their lives. Maybe not even in their lives, but maybe in their parents' lives, and that sort of carried forward.
Yeah. I've seen that. I know some people from Taiwan, they have a lot of money and they'll use every tea bag two or three times. And it doesn't taste good the second and third time. But that is exactly that. That's that kind of thrift.
Yeah. Everyone has different modes of behavior, and I just, you know, I like to mine the comedy in that and the absurdity of people with way too much money being obsessed with, you know, for example, you know, parking lot fees and not wanting to park their car. And so they make their chauffeurs, you know, drive around and circle around for 3 hours, wasting God knows how much, you know, in gas money, just so they don't have to pay $2.50 in parking. So it makes no sense. But, you know, a lot of what the rich do make no sense.
We're talking to Kevin Kwan about his book, China Rich Girlfriend. One of the little plots, which I thought was so funny, was this woman, Kitty, who was trying to, she's another one of these people who, she has the money but doesn't have the name and the breeding and so on. She's trying to make her way into society. She is married to a man who has a botched plastic surgery. He moved, which in itself is a whole piece of comedy. He moves to Los Angeles to what for him is a very downmarket neighborhood, but for most of us would be considered probably an upper class or upper middle class neighborhood. And he's basically taken their daughter and is raising her. She's 3 years old, to speak five languages, to take coding classes, to go into sensory isolation mindfulness tanks. And she's on a sugar-free, gluten-free, organic farm-to-table paleo diet, drinking reverse osmosis water, and isn't allowed to wear clothes that reinforce gender stereotypes and fairy tale narratives. And it's so hilarious because these are the sort of like, these are the pieces of the kind of discourse that goes on in American universities about gender and class and food and all that kind of stuff. And her mother and her mother's class consultant want to basically kidnap her and take her back to live in palatial buildings and eat macaroons all day.
Yeah,
exactly. And you, as a reader, you're like, I don't even know what to think because both of them are so weirdly grotesque. And yes, there's
a
lot of comedy
extremes.
In that, but
it's polar extremes,
right? It's polar extremes of wealth. You know, the extreme of normality or the extreme of poverty. It's not even in there, except for her. What is it? You had a wonderful way of phrasing this. She goes for her, the little girl Giselle's father is sending her to, after her float session in Venice Beach, she has an hour of undirected play with her real world immersion friends in Compton.
And you know, this comes from a friend of mine in California who was making me a list of exactly what these really high net worth parents are doing these days for their children. They are literally buying houses in middle class or working class neighborhoods so their kids can go there for 3 hours in the afternoon and get to know the real world and have sort of neighborhood friends there. So they're going to be prepared for a little bit of the real world. It's unbelievable, but it's all true.
As if somebody showing up 3 hours a day would be accepted as a real person.
Exactly. But it's, you know, the heights of ridiculousness to how, you know, a lot of these high net worth parents are really choosing to try to give their children everything educationally.
Yeah.
You know, it's reached levels of absurdity. But it also speaks to the Chinese culture, to how much education is valued. And they will go to such great lengths to ensure that their kids have the ultimate advantage, you know, in terms of winning the prize, which is to get into an Ivy League school, you know, and they start, you know, from inception.
Right.
Training the child and preparing the child.
And as you said before, making up for lost time and lost opportunities in generations past.
Exactly. And, you know, with this character of Bernard, you know, he was the classic kid that was ignored by his parents, you know, who were so busy building the fortune. And so now he's doing the exact opposite with his child and really kind of, you know, overwhelming this three-year-old with way, you know, to me, way excessive levels of education and
right.
smothering.
And ignoring the most fundamental things that we know about child development.
Exactly.
I think it's really, I mean, when I was reading this, I was having fun. I mean, I was listening to Lydia Look. I was also thinking of Marie Antoinette and Versailles and all the crazy top-heavy class-based structures that we've had in the past that fell over and fell over through revolution or what, you know, one way or another. And when you think about, like, how do you think about the huge amount of Asian money now with respect to history?
It's so interesting because I always say this, you know, this has always happened before. You know, what I write about, in a way, is a new location, but it's nothing new. You know, Edith Wharton, Henry James, they were writing about, you know, the rich Americans that sort of invaded Europe at the turn of the century. And even before that, in the Victorian age, Trollope was writing about the nouveau riche British that were invading into British politics. This is just the latest iteration. Right now, the locus of wealth, the center of gravity for wealth, has moved to China. And there are all these extremely high net worth individuals running these companies. And really, to me, it seems like so many of them, they haven't been educated with a conscience. So they are, in many ways, polluting and destroying their own countries. With the factories, with the industry, with, you know, the non-regulation, it's sort of reached epic and tragic proportions. In China for the local Chinese, and the people at the top of the heap, they don't care because they're not going to be there. You know, half their families already live in Sydney or LA or Vancouver. You know, the kids have all gotten out and are going to Ivy League schools. So there is this sort of lack of education and a lack of conscience that is I think really profoundly going to be affecting China and the region and, you know, the world environment for years to come.
It's an interesting thing. And in that respect, I suppose it's a little different from, let's say, Versailles. They get very wealthy. They move their families away. They move their wealth away. So that wealth doesn't necessarily trickle down to the people who need it.
Not at all.
And in addition to that, the impact that they can make, the carbon footprint, the destruction of species, the destruction of oceans, the whole environmental thing is so much, and just the population of China alone is so much more destructive and potentially destructive than anything we've known.
Very much so. And, you know, these are actually issues that I will be tackling in Rich People Problems.
Yeah. Very interesting. So, we're talking to Kevin Kwan, and the first book, Crazy Rich Asians, is in the process of being made into a Hollywood movie. Tell us about how that happened and what this process is like and what your role as writer is in it.
You know, it's been very exciting from the very beginning, and the book became very much of an interest to Hollywood even before it was published. Even before the book came out, there were a lot of producers that were interested in acquiring the movie rights. And so I really hadn't thought too much about that when I wrote the book. You know, I didn't write the book intending it for it to ever become a movie. But as I began into the process, I really felt like I wanted to partner up with a fantastic team that really had a proven track record of adapting books to viable, interesting, acclaimed movies. And so I chose to work with Nina Jacobson, who is, you know, well known for adapting the Hunger Games books And now she's also doing, you know, Where'd You Go, Bernadette? Bernadette. She's also doing Donna Tartt's book. What's it called? It escapes. The Goldfinch. And so she's had an amazing track record of working with authors and really being faithful to the material, but also transforming it into great movies. So it's been really fun to sort of watch the evolution of my book into, you know, we're now about to go into pre-production with the movie. And the acclaimed director, John Chu, is going to be directing the movie. And it's going to be really the first movie in over two decades with a primarily all-Asian cast.
Very
that has not been done since the Joy Luck Club.
Yeah.
Amy Tan's Joy Luck Club back in the early, was it early 90s or late 80s? So it's really kind of happening at such an interesting moment culturally, because, you know, ever since, you know, the last disastrous Oscar awards, there's been a new awareness of how Asian Americans are so underrepresented in Hollywood, in movies, in TV. And, you know, there's so many sort of bad stereotypes that need to be really reexamined.
Well, one of the things that, I mean, I think is so interesting about the book is it draws you in because of the great storytelling. It allows you to think about and have conversations about what is going on culturally, what is going on class and money-wise. And I would think that in a movie, you would have to be really careful about, you know, whether you are satirizing, glorifying, or walking that fine line.
You really have to be, and that's why I decided to not write the screenplay myself. You know, I felt I was too close to the material, and really, at that time, I didn't feel like I had the expertise to really kind of, you know, from my over 400-page book, tease out, you know, an hour and 45-minute long movie. I just didn't think I would be the right person to make those hard choices of which stories to tell. So we worked with, you know, a number of really talented, you know, acclaimed screenwriters, the first one being Keith Bunin, the acclaimed playwright, who really sort of created a whole new structure to tell the story in film form. And then, you know, so the comedic screenwriter Pete Chiarelli came on as well. He's very well known for a romantic comedy called The Proposal, starring Sandra Bullock, to sort of add that extra level of comedy and spice. And I love the script. It's interesting, you know, because it's not going to be a word-for-word reenactment of the book, but it very much captures the DNA and the spirit of the book, and I think is telling the right tales.
Are you at all involved in the casting? I would think it would be very important to make sure that in the same way that Lydia Look got all the accents right and all the sort of cultural pieces right, that people are cast properly. And I ask you this because I remember when, in the years when Latino people, South American, Central American, Mexican people were first being cast in American Hollywood movies, they got it so wrong.
They really did. And it's something that my producers are very, very conscious of. And yes, I am involved in the casting. I'm an executive producer of the movie. And we've really, really, we're going to great lengths to ensure that every character sound like they should. You know, even down to the accent that they have, the type of English accent that they have is very much a sort of a signifier of where they come from, as we talked about earlier in the interview. So
yeah.
It's these are issues that my producers are very, very much aware of and want to be very faithful to how the characters are portrayed in the books.
How has your family, how have your friends from perhaps your childhood from Singapore responded to your books?
You know, it's so interesting. I would say that there are two distinct camps, people who have read the book and people who have not read the book. And believe it or not, a lot of my family and my friends from Singapore have not read the book. It's reading. It's not a big deal there, it seems. You know, people don't have that much time to read. And fiction kind of is sort of the stepchild of, you know, the book world in Asia. I think people, if they read anything, they read sort of self-help books or how to make money books, you know, finance type books. So I've met a lot of people, you know, who say, oh, I'm sorry, I haven't read your book yet. Maybe they're being polite. Who knows? But the ones who have read my book have been overwhelmingly supportive. A lot of the people in Singapore and Hong Kong that have read my book, I find, if you're in the goldfish bowl, you're not really seeing the nuances of it, I find. And so a lot of them don't, you know, they don't see the comedy that I think Western readers might.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and I find, for example, that Singaporeans and Hong Kongers and, you know, Asians who have left Asia are the super fans because they appreciate it on such a deep level and they get it. And they, you know, now that they're out of the goldfish bowl, they can really see it in the way that I've seen it.
Now, have you had mainland Chinese people read it, and has it been translated into Chinese?
It has not been translated into Chinese, but the book is actually quite popular in English in China. And in fact, I heard from a university professor a few weeks ago that told me she was teaching my book in her class at Beijing Normal University. And I think in China, they're, you know, they are so aware of what's happening with the wealth and the clash between the have and the have-nots that this has become a very fascinating book for them to read. At the same time, you know, the reason why the book hasn't been translated, I think, is because publishers there are very wary of how the government might respond to a book that really reveals sort of, you know, the scandals and the controversies and,
right.
and all this access to a mass public. But the ones who have read it have been, you know, very, very sort of positive in their reaction.
So what's next? You're working on this movie and you also have the third book in the trilogy. Did you conceive of this whole thing as a trilogy?
I did. I very much from the very beginning had an idea of this entire story and how I was going to tell it. And I knew that I would kill myself if I tried to write, you know, an 1,800-page book.
Right.
I'm not Tolstoy.
And nobody would read it.
No one would read it. So I really felt like the trilogy was the way to go. And so now I'm really sort of hard at work on the third and final book. It's called Rich People Problems. And if all goes well, it will be out next year.
Give us a hint of what some of those rich people problems are.
Oh, gosh. You know, it's really more just the overarching issues that need to be addressed in the books with this family. What happens in the end? Because as you know from book two, it does end on a bit of a cliffhanger. Will certain characters find happiness? You know, will certain characters sort of, you know, make up with their families and
right.
things like that? And you know, these are very much rich people problems, I think. At least the characters in my book are experiencing that. So it really sort of hopefully will give closure and also more understanding of this family that I've written about, because I am going back much more into the past with the third book.
Interesting.
And it was also my plan in all three books to really showcase different parts of Asia. You know, people, I think, especially in the West, often think of Asia as just China. But there are so many really distinct cultures and countries. There's Singapore, there's Hong Kong, there's Thailand, the Philippines, Taiwan. You know, Japan is a whole other can of worms. They don't even consider themselves part of Asia, so we won't even get into that. But I wanted to show the world of the overseas Chinese, the Chinese who have immigrated, you know, through the centuries throughout the rest of Southeast Asia and the Pacific Rim, and the ones that are here in the U.S.
Will the movie be shot on location? In other words, will we have the chance to actually kind of see and feel those different worlds?
Yes, very much so. So in fact, my, you know, the movie team is going to Singapore next week to begin location scouting.
Well, I have to say it's an education and it's been for me a kind of like reflection of my own ignorance and a good one because it's a way in. It's a way in for those of us who maybe don't want to sort of dive into a history book.
Hopefully a funny way in.
It's hilarious.
Hopefully, you know, some. Ultimately, I really meant to write books that would make people laugh.
Oh, yeah.
And make people feel hungry in the middle of the night when they're reading and, you know.
Again, the food thing is so over the top
yeah.
and so interesting. And your mastery of the names of designer shoes and clothing and stores and cars and objects is completely beyond my comprehension. Did you learn all that stuff for the book or did you, like, know it?
I very much knew it. I think because, you know, Asians are the ultimate label whores,
yeah.
I have to say. And, you know, especially in the last 20, 25 years, the entire luxury industry has become catered towards Asia. You know, Asians now account for 70% of the consumption of luxury goods in the world. And so this, you know, it's kind of funny because the name dropping that goes on in my books is very much a part of daily life when you go to Asia.
Yeah.
In a way that I'm not accustomed to. You know, when I go there and visit cousins and things like that, they're always going, oh, who made your shoes? Oh, what watch are you wearing now? And to me, I'm so uncomfortable about that. You know, I personally go to great lengths not to wear things that have labels on them. But whereas, you know, Crazy Rich Asians are obsessed with labels.
Again, it's exhausting.
It is exhausting.
It's an exhausting way of life, and it's a way of life that it's not as free, it's not as privileged, and it's not as happy as we might think and hope.
You know, money comes with its whole can of worms, and in many ways it can be very, very oppressive.
Well, Kevin Kwan, I want to thank you very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. Kevin is the author of the book China Rich Girlfriend that just came out in paperback. It's the second book in the trilogy. The first is Crazy Rich Asians. The third will be called Rich People Problems. That's out next year?
Hopefully.
Hopefully
knock
next
on wood.
Year. Knock. Here we go. Knock on wood. And when might we expect the film?
We'll see. I mean, it's going into production this year.
Okay.
So next year, I'm hoping. We'll see.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's been really fun. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.